So, as long as this structure of internal relation remain intact, individual units are replaceable. So this is just another critic, another element who was heavily criticized from the Supreme, says that if you can replace all the elements and that do not affect the structure, then why things are going to change? I mean, there is no change there. Because if you, as far you keep the proportion, as far you keep the relations, the structure is the same, then if every element that you replace one way or the other, well, that means that you have the same structure always. So the idea of change, the idea of radical change, the idea of revolution was a little bit absent there. And some critics of the Structuralism says that there was a theory to justify things, not to change things, basically. So it was a theory working with the statu quo. That was what they were saying. Three other points might be noted about the method. First, it does no matter to Structuralism that this story is hardly an example of great literature. The Beetle is quite indifferent to the cultural value of his object. You see, that's what I said before. Anything from war and peace or to war cry will do. The Beetle is analytical, no evaluative. Second, Structuralism is a calculated affront to common sense. It refutes the obvious meaning of a story and seeks instead to isolate certain deep structures within it, which are not apparent on the surface. Of course, this was a direct critic to the to this traditional way to do literature, was the close reading, the idea that literature or critics of literature should devote themselves to the common sense, and that was having a close reading. So, reading a book and see what came up with story, or what kind of story you came up. So that was specifically criticized, in the sense in which they were saying that what is obvious in literature is not connected with common sense, it's connected with something that you don't see, which is in between lines. Common sense could be the way in which two characters connect between them, but certainly is not the same that say that interpretation need to be in agreement with common sense. Probably the most extreme case for that was all the avant-garde movements of the beginning of the 20th century in Europe, when these people of Surrealism, for example, they were provoking, trying to make clear to you that interpretation could be a silly thing. Maybe you have an object who normally is not considered as a object of art, but that exactly is the way to provoke you to think that maybe common sense is not the best way to judge aesthetics. That's what's the idea. It refused the obvious meaning of a story and seeks instead to isolate certain deep structure within it, which are not apparent to the surface. It does not take the text at the face value, but displays it into a quite different kind of object. Third, if the particular contents of the text are replaceable, there is a sense in which one can say that the content of the narrative is his structure. You see what I said before. It's the structure who determines the borderline, if you want, of the subject. That's why the critics were saying that when they were writing the analysis, because they were aware of this third point, they were exercising as well the content. You see, writing about a particular books in the way in which you write is as well in the way in which you discuss. Basically, if your analysis is complicated, your writing probably is going to be complicated. If your analysis is simple, your writing is going to be simple. Because writing for these people represents as well the level of the content that you are analyzing. They were connected. You cannot separate them to the other. Of course, this creates a lot of polemics because people were basically saying that was an abuse, that critics pretend to be at the same level than writers, because some of them more traditionally were thinking that writers have more talent and produce a kind of writing in terms of doing novel and so on, is something, is a sort of talent. I mean, and you working in university producing an analysis is not necessarily a talent, it's a job. It's something that you can do because it's your job. You see, that kind of always were divided. Writers related to structuralism, those who believe that be a writer you have a natural talent, and those who believe that be a writer is something that is a part of education, in which you learn how to be a writer. And of course, according to you have one position to the other, you were in favor of the structuralism or you were against. In fact, no by chance, quite a lot of critics, especially in France, who positioned themselves as a structuralist were as well writers. So that is not strange, because this idea. Literary structuralism flourishes in the 1960s as a term to apply to literature the methods and insights of the founder of modern structural linguistics, Ferdinand de Saussure. She has made a popularized account of the Saussure epoch making course in general linguistics, 1916. And now available, I shall merely sketch in a few of his central positions. Saussure viewed language as a system of signs, which was to be studied synchronically, that is to say, studied as a complete system at a given point in time, rather than the accordingly it is in his historical development. You see? This is. Okay, let's go again. Saussure viewed language as a system of study which was to be studied synchronically, that is to say, study a complete system at a given point in time. So, this is specific. And this is comparative. So, each sign was to be seen as a being made up of signifier, a sound image of the graphic equivalent, a signifier, the concept or meaning. The three black marks CAT are a signifier which evoke the signified cat in an English mind. Remember what I explained to you. Yeah, this is a without time, a temporal and temporal. That means that this is a comparative style. The acronym is comparative always. It's historical orientated. And the other, you don't pay attention to the historical sequence. You just concentrate and focus in one particular point. You see? This is, in linguistics, this is our, if you want, the two main approach. There are linguistics who consider that you need to understand language how it evolved in terms of time and compare with different experience and different modifications and variations, and you have the other who says no, we need to focus in a particular moment, in a particular period, isolate that from the rest and then make our mind. That is that. So still picking up that, but that has been for a while in linguistics. So basically, if you remember, we discussed a sign, so you have the object, you have the meaning, and you have the interpreter. These are the three elements of a sign. Very simple. Different names vary one person to the other. Some people say that interpreter is not important, some others say that if the origin is absent you can do well anyway, but basically those are the elements in a sign. So Saussure was saying that if we want to stay a society, we need to create a sort of science of sign, and he called that semiosis. So he was saying that we should have a sort of science, a science of science, who will be studying all the signs of a particular society, which will allow us to have all the understanding and all the knowledge, all the background necessary to have a knowledge. in that particular piece. Questions? No? Well, you know that already, do you? No?
Yeah. More or less.
The relation between the whole sign and what it refers to, what Saussure calls the referent, the real fury, is therefore also arbitrary. In the linguistic system, says Saussure, there are only differences. Meaning is not mysterious, immanent in a sign, but is functional, the result of his difference from other signs. Finally, Saussure believed that linguistic will get into a hopeless mess if it concerned itself with actual speech, or parole, as he called it. You see, what he was saying is that the reason why, an example, we have an object we call chair, the reason why there is a person like me, you know, talking about chair, and there is a meaning of chair, the reason why to that thing, gray, with four legs, we call a chair, is arbitrary. We accept it because it's a convention. We use it. We are not start to question, no, that's not a table, that's a chair, I mean, no make any sense. But at the origin, the language is an arbitrary convention. There is no reason why that particular material object could be named table and not chair. But at the beginning, all the people, when they decided, they call it table. So, that carry on the sense and the meaning. And because it's practical, and because it's there, we use it. But make the hell of difference if you consider that language is arbitrary or is determined, because this has been the whole discussion of the 19th century. People who believe that nature was there with capitals determined everything who happened to human beings, including languages. So if you believe that language is determined by nature, you believe that the names have a substance. The chair is chair because of a particular element who made that different than the rest. So you talk about essences, you see. This guy, Saussure, will say, there are no essences. The reason why the chair is chair is because four guys, one day taking a beer, decided I won't call it chair. All the people found it that funny, and that for the century has been called it chair. And that's it. And that's made the hell of a difference. That means that there is no essence within the objects. And that means that one particular object can function in one society in one way, but after one century or two, can function in another different way. And this is important, because that means that you don't have eternal values, you don't have eternal objects. Objects, the meaning of object, the meaning of what concept people are using, are historically orientated. So he was as well talking about these two differences to approach a problem from the point of view of the language or from the point of view of the word. They were the two main units, if you will. And he, as you say, he was saying that if you pay attention to the word, we became mad, because it would be too complicated. The best thing to do is la langue, no? What they say, Saussure, the language. Just pay attention to the language, which is the big panorama, if you want to know where we are. So, the last part in 84 says, estructuralism in general is an attempt to apply this linguistic theory to objects and activities other than language itself. Remember when I say this. You can view a myth, wrestling match, system of tribal kinship, restaurant menu, or oil painting as a system of science. And a structuralist analysis will try to isolate the underlying set of law by which these signs are combined into meaning. You see, remember what we discussed at the beginning. We are living in a society in which we are surrounded by all kind of values, by symbols, basically. And we don't have any more a clear picture about a hierarchy, which symbol should come before or later. So we have this problem that we are facing in our ordinary life, a quite big amount of symbolic values, a quite big amount of objects. So we need in some ways to figure out a theory who will allow us to have some kind of understanding of this chaotic population of objects. Because if we don't have a religious system anymore, if we don't have the idea of a nature with capital, then which one is going to be the order of these things within our society? Well, the structuralism says that's the reason why we need to create a theory, to make some kind of classification, to make some kind of taxonomy among these objects, and to see if there is any hierarchy, what is the meaning of that? Or if for the meaning of our world, we need to establish a particular set or pattern. So if we largely ignore what the signs actually say and concentrate instead on their internal relation to one another, structuralism, as Frederick Jameson has put it, is an attempt to rethink everything through once again in terms of linguistics. It is a symptom of the fact that language, with its problems, mysteries, and implications, has become both paradigm and obsession for 20th century intellectual life. So, serious linguistic views influenced the Russian formalist, although formalism is not itself exactly a structuralism. His view led a text structurally and suspend attention of the referent to examine the sign itself, but it is not particularly concerned with the meaning as differential or in much of his work with the deep law and the structure underlying literary text. Probably Pope is one of the few who really was much orientated to this idea of structuralism more than the others. It was one of the Russian formalists, however, the linguist Roman Jakobson, who was to provide the major link between formalism and modern-day structuralism. Jakobson was leader of the Moscow Linguistic Circle, a formalist group founded in 1915 and in 1920 related to Peg, and to become one of the major theoreticians of the Czech structuralism. All communication for Jakobson involved six elements: an addresser, an address, a message passing between them, a shared code which make the message intelligible, a contact or physical medium of communication, and a context to which the message refers. This is another very, very simple way as well to get an essay done. You have a book from Jakobson which is called Essays of General Linguistics, in which you have two or three essays who are really the key essay for this theory, and the theory is very simple. If you put the accent in a particular, from these seven elements, you put the accent in one, you have a particular kind of result. You put the accent in another, you have a particular kind. The most sophisticated one is the poetic one, which you put your attention in the channel. But there are also all kinds of sophistication. An example, one who was very famous in the 90s was this idea that, you know, when you're picking up the phone and you check the channel, you say, hello, hello, you know, so you are checking the channel, using, that is called función fática. And according to some postmodern theoreticians, that was, this kind of hello, hello is the representation of modern art. The art do not give any message to you, only check the channel. You know? And they use this I think was Max Kidrum, you know Max Kidrum, this cartoon, a guy with a camera here in the shoulder. That was the example he was saying, that all these series of cartoons were not trying to communicate nothing, just only checking constantly the channel. So that's one of the perspectives from Jakobson. Jakobson also made 86 much of the distinction implicit in Saussure between the metaphorical and metonymic. In metaphor, one sign is substitute for another because it is somehow similar to it. Passion became flame. In metonymy, or one sign is associated with another. This again has generated quite a huge amount of analysis, because as you see, it's very, very simple. You pick it up, the metonymies, you classify them, you see what is the first meaning of that, you see the second meaning, and then you make your interpretation of the plot. That's a piece of cake. Some literary form, there is prose, for example, tend to be metonymic, linking sign, but their association with each other. Other forms, as a romantic or symbolist poetry, are highly metaphorically. You see, using the rhetorical figures, you can as well have a particular classification or characterization of the type of literature you are doing. And you can go more deeply, and even the way in which you use language, you can do that. An example, I remember reading works when I was a student that characterized the realism as a sort of a style in which you use verbs, but present and past, but no continuous verbs. I mean, you use very clear determined period. You have present with present, or past with past and gone, you know. So that kind of and then within that you can have different kind of realism. The realism who have a dimension of the present who is more important, and the other realism who in which the past is more important. You see, you can go deeper and deeper in that direction. What time is that? Well, are doing well? 25 to 6. Okay. 87 at the bottom. The American founder of semiotic, the philosopher Charles Sumner Peirce, distinguishes between three basic kinds of sign. There was the iconic, where the sign somehow resembled to what is stood for, a photograph or a person, for example. The indexical, in which the sign is somehow associated with what is sign. It is a sign of smoke with fire, spoke with males. Three, the symbolic, where as we assume the sign is only arbitrarily or conventionally linked with his reference. Semiotics take up these and many other classifications. He distinguishes between denotation, what the sign stands for, and connotation, other sign associated with it. Between call, the room governance structure which produce meanings, and messages transmitted by them. Between the paradigmatic, a whole class of signs which might stand in for and one another, and a syntagmatic, where signs are coupled together with each other in a chain. It speaks of meta-languages, where one sign system denotes another sign system. The relation between literary criticism and literature, for instance. Polysemics, signs which have more than one meaning, and great many other technical concepts. To see what this kind of analysis looks in practice, we might briefly consider the work of a leading Soviet semiotician, the so-called School of Tartu, Yuri Lotman. In his work, The Structure of Artistic Texts and the Analysis of the Poetic Text, Lotman sees the poetic text as a stratified system in which meaning only exists contextually, governed by a set of similarities and oppositions. Differences and parallelism in the text are themselves relative terms and can only be perceived in relation to one another. In poetry, it is the nature of the signifier, the pattern of sound and rhythmic setup by the marks on the page themselves, which determine what is signified. A poetic text is semantically saturated, condensing more information than any other discourse, but whereas for modern communication theory in general, an increase in information leads to decrease in communication, since I cannot take in all that you so intensely tell me. This is not in poetry because of his unique kind of internal organization. Poetry has a minimum of redundancy of those signs which are present in a discourse to facilitate communication rather than to convey information, but they still manage to produce a richer set of messages than any other form of languages. Poems are bad when they do not carry sufficient information, for, as Lotman remarked, information is beauty. It's not only information, because other authors discussed it. It's efficacy. I mean, poetry works when you have efficacy. When something you say in a particular way is very rich in terms of meanings, and there is no other one who replaces you. I mean, this happened, for example, when you you read poetry that you find very, very simple, and you don't realize what could be the value of that. But you realize that the way in which the guy has been saying things is not really normal, and is very, very precise, and give you the sense of new meaning. There are several examples of that. An example, well, the one who came in always is Borges. I mean, because he's writing in a very simple way. I mean, there are no complicated words in his poetry. But when you try to make up the whole meaning of that, ooh, that's another matter. And that's when you see efficacy. And that was as well important for the formalism, but as well for the traditionalism. The fact that, because you remember, the functionality in one way or the other make the difference. So things are more functional than others, because they are they have some kind of extra efficacy regarding to the others. Why do people use a particular word and abandon another? Because it's short, because take less time, because have much meaning than another, because you can say that more directly, because with one word you can say many things. All those reasons, among others, are the reason why you drop one word and you use the other. This is called efficacy. In linguistics there is something called the five rules of Grice. Grice was a linguistic in California, and he was explaining why people drop one word and pick another the other. And the reasons were these: because they are economical, they are direct, in some ways they are functional more than the previous one. Lambert does not consider that poetry or literature can be defined by their inner linguistic properties. The meaning of the text is not just an internal matter, it also inherits in the text's relation to wider system of meaning, to other texts, cults and norms in literature and society as a whole. You see what we were discussing before. Its meaning is also relative to the reader's horizon of expectation. Lotman has learned the lesson of a reception theory well. It is the reader who, by virtue of a certain receptive code at his or her disposal, identify an element in the work as a device. The device is not a simple internal feature, but one perceived through a particular code and against the definitive textual background. One person's poetic device might be another daily speech. You see, this is the relativeness, if you want, of this approach, that some people can consider normal speech what others might consider as a literature. And this created quite a lot of discussion as well during the 60s and the 70s, because all the people were claiming that they were writers. So the question was, okay, if everyone is a writer, if everyone has a talent, if everyone can do literature, then how we are going to make distinction ordinary writing from literature? Which one is going to be the parameters to make distinction? Not necessarily between good and bad literature, but between ordinary writing and what we can consider society literature. So that's what semiotics represent. In fact, is literary criticism transfigured by a structural linguistic, rendered a more disciplined and less impressionistic enterprise, which, as Lotman's work testifies, is more rather than less alive to the wealth of form and language than most traditional criticism. Indeed, it created a whole new literary science, narratology, of which the most influential practitioner has been the Lithuanian Greimas, the Bulgarian Todorov, and the French critic Gérard Genet, Claude Bremont and Roland Barthes. The modern structuralist analysis of narrative began with the pioneering work of the myth of French anthropologist Claude Lévi-Strauss, who viewed apparently different myths and values of a number of basic themes or arguments. Well, the vision here from Ingleton, it's a little bit simplistic regarding to semiotics. I mean, in the sense, it's true that there is a connection with the traditionalism, but semiotics was trying to, in one way or the other, to address two or three questions that estructuralism didn't bother that much. Since estructuralism will get entangled with the linguistic and get concerned pretty much with the literature, they never address other problems. An example, what happened with the domain of painting, what happened with the domain of visual, what happened with the domain of communication, and so on. Even if at the beginning they were concerned with that, but at the end they end up in a sort of analysis that they didn't show it, how, from the structuralism point of view, we should analyze them more properly. To be honest, to be more fair with the semiotics, they were the ones who really addressed all these problems. In fact, in semiotics you have plenty of different schools, which one, I mean, has been different according to what they dedicate themselves. You have a semiotic approach to communication, semiotic approach to media and TV, semiotic approach to cinema and so on, because that is the nature of the semiotics. It's the nature to explain all together all kind of different manifestations. That's why Saussure was thinking as the science of science, because it's something who should be powerful enough to produce analysis contemporary of different subjects. You see? So in that sense I think Eagleton is not very fair. I think that as an overall is pretty much like that. I mean, there are information here that you can pick it up, and it's historical information about how they came up and who are the schoolmasters and things like that, but the important element is there. In 96, for Saussure, historical change was something which afflicted the individual elements of a language and could only in this indirect way affect the whole. The language as a whole will reorganize itself to accommodate such disturbance. You see, this is typical from Saussure. It's the whole who explain the part, or if you want, control the part in one way or the other. Jacobson and his colleague Judy Tignano saw the history of literature as itself forming a system in which at any given point some forms and genres were dominant while others were subordinate. Literary development took place by way of shift within this hierarchical system, such that a previous dominant form became a subordinate or vice versa. The history of a system, Jacobson and Tignano comment, is itself a system. Diachrony can be studied synchronically. Society itself was made up of a whole of set of systems, or series, as the formalists call it then, each of which was powered by his own internal law, and evolved in relative autonomy of all the other. You see, the critic is that you start this cascade effect and you never end, because one structure drives you to the other, one system to the other, and so on and so on and so on. That was the bad side, if you want, of this theory. Why some people were shifting from structuralism into semiotics? Well, because of the complexity of the, if you want, of the culture. I mean, what the structuralism failed to achieve was a clear explanation, an example of a particular literary text in connection with the idea of culture. Even if that was the main purpose of them, is paradoxical, they failed to achieve that, and they produced good analysis but isolated, not in connection with that. And according to some critics, the reason of that was because the conceptual system they were using was too limited, and that's when some structuralists moved into semiotics, because they felt, as I even pointed out, that semiotic have a more rich and big conceptual lexicon and allow them to talk about different things at the same moment. Therefore, you can produce, let's say, an analysis of Dickens if you want, but at the same time you can have a semiotical approach of the culture of a period without losing any perspective. So that's why happened. And also semiotic acknowledge one element that the Sufism didn't, is the visual component of our culture. For semiotician, the idea that we are living in a culture dominated by visual images was something granted, taking as a granted. For structuralism, no, because they were coming from an idea of linguistic, from a period in which the visual dimension of the culture was not evident. So basically what I'm saying to you is that semiotician says that structuralism failed to explain all the visual dimension of our culture. They were not able to talk about painting, for example. Or if they do it, they do it in an isolated way. They cannot explain that in connection with other artistic manifestations. And that is applicable as well to cinema. The structuralism analysis of cinema were, in one way or the other, considered as a limited in the way in which they were, yes, working okay within cinema, but when you try to explain the connection between those analyses and cinema with a sort of a general idea of culture, they fail to provide that. And that is why you have this, or not you, but this is why structuralism have this kind of reputation of a sort of critic school, a sort of language only for those who really are initiated there. Is because they were producing this sort of autonomous analysis with this jargon, and then they were not making any effort to explain from another perspective what they were doing in a particular discipline. So they were isolated, and that's when other people saw this analysis as sort of school who want not really to go anywhere, basically, just stay among them, and that's it. That was the main critique to the most famous journal. The most famous journal of this movement was Tekel, which was a magazine published in Paris during the 60s and the 70s. And the critics were saying that there was a sort of church in which all the believers were there, and if you are a believer, you are there. You know, you are out, and that's it. You don't understand nothing. Basically, that was the idea. That is. Yeah, I think that's it. So, read the whole chapter line by line. Let me know. Ask me a thing. I'm concerned that you don't ask me nothing ever. It's because you are not reading the book. It's because you understand everything. It's because what I'm saying to you is very simple. I can get more complicated if you want. You just ask me. this is basic. I promise you. If you think this is complicated, oh dear, you don't have an idea. This is very basic. And I'm going to follow the book. I mean, I.
Do you
follow
this one?
No.
Rely more on the
yes. I agree with you, but as I said at the beginning, I mean, he says, the thing I really don't like from him is this. He says, structuralism is this. And structuralism is not that. I mean, it would be more accurate to say, structuralism has been claimed to be this, and I think structuralism is this. So he gives you the. No, he believes he is empowered of some kind of light and enlighten you. So that, in that sense, yes. Oh yeah, that's clear. And there is another book that if we have time, we are going to cover quickly, call it After Theory. 20 years after this book, he wrote another one to justify all the holes that we're having here. Oh, that's very fun. It's very fun, that one. But you can rely on that one, because the introductions to the text in that are really introductions. And then you have the original sources. I mean, you have Marx, extract from Marx. I mean, you have the main. So is that is much better. Merci beaucoup.